Don.
Okay, I'd like to thank the organizers for having me give a talk here. So I'm going to talk about work that's in this paper here. Also relevant is some original work by Vladimir Rosenhaus and Misha Smolkin. And somewhat tangentially relevant is a series of papers by Van Ramsdonk et al., including me and some other people, and some series of people where he, you know, this work was deriving Einstein's equations from something called the first order of entanglement entropy. This is tangentially related. So basically, what I'm going to present today is essentially just a field theory calculation of geometric entanglement entropy. I'm going to be using the tools of conformal field theory, in particular conformal field theory in higher dimensions, so bigger than two dimensions. Basically, I'm going to be doing conformal perturbation theory. This is an entanglement workshop, but I don't really need to motivate this, but I will give some motivations which are relevant for what I'm going to talk about. So the first motivation is this link between entanglement and the emergence of gravity. This is set up in ADS-CFT, where the picture is we have some quantum field theory, and so it lives on the boundary of some high-dimensional space. I'll draw like this, there's some extra dimension here, z direction here, and there's some gravity theory in the bulk. This is the boundary, and these two things are meant to be exactly dual to each other, or some class of quantum field theories. This is a picture where, just from quantum field theory, it's not clear, if you just look at the quantum field theory, it's not clear, but somehow contained within it is a theory of gravity. And this is really interesting. More interesting is the architect of this of the emergence of this gravitational dual seems to be entanglement. So the idea here is that in the quantum field theory, we can think about calculating geometric entanglement entropy. So we take our Hilbert, we take some state in our Hilbert space, which is a tensor product between degrees of freedom inside the region A and everything outside the region A. We trace over everything we're not interested in. And then we calculate the von Neumann entropy of this density matrix, which is now mixed. And that gives us our entanglement entropy. And a result due to Ryu and Takayanagi, and then generalized later to time-dependent situations by Hubini, Rangamani, and Takayanagi, is that in this setup, in ADS-CFT, entanglement entropy is calculated in a very simple way. It's just the area of some minimal surface divided by 4g Newton in this bulk space-time, where this minimal surface is anchored at the boundary of the minimal surface is anchored at the boundary of the region A. Okay, so this seems to suggest a really deep link between the emergence of this geometry and entanglement in the boundary field theory. So there's a question, how universal is this formula? Based on expectations from ADS-CFT, we might say, this formula only applies when the quantum field theory has a classical gravity dual. Okay, so what are the conditions for having a classical gravitational dual? Well, this set of conditions that people have worked out over the years, but basically there's two main conditions. One is that you need your CFT or your quantum field theory to have a large number of degrees of freedom, essentially per site, and to be very strongly coupled. Okay, and so this maps to, in the bulk, the fact that G Newton is small, so G Newton goes like 1 over this number here. And this maps to the fact that in the bulk, you can have some kind of local effective field theory description of the gravity. It turns out that there are actually hints that this might apply beyond this, this set of conditions. So, for example, in 1+1 dimensions, in 1+1 dimensions, there's a nice set of conditions essentially worked out by Tom Hartmann et al, which is that the entanglement entropy takes a form like this in any CFT which has a large central charge and some condition on the spectrum of operator dimensions. So the sparseness condition, which I'm not going to go into. But this is somewhat interesting because this large central charge corresponds to this limit. So we still need to take a large number of degrees of freedom. That's okay. But in some sense, this condition is well beyond this. Right? So you don't have to take a very strongly coupled CFT to see a result like this. But in bigger than 1+1 dimensions, you expect new features from the classical gravity dual. In particular, in 1+1 dimensions, the duality is a three-dimensional gravity theory, and that doesn't have any propagating gravitons. So in some sense, things simplify, and that was what lies. That was the power behind this result. So I'm going to concentrate on bigger than 1+1 dimensions. And just to preview, what I'm going to find is that there's essentially a controllable calculation where I can calculate entanglement entropy, where this formula applies in any CFT.
Okay.
Yes.
So I thought that in 1+1, Lotka-Nyhanagi works. Just works for any CFT.
It does for a single interval. Right, but as soon as you have more than one interval, so a single interval is somewhat trivial, right? So, in high dimensions you can deform the shape of the surface. In one dimensions you just have intervals. But for multiple intervals it turns out that a formula like this applies with some sort of very very general conditions on your CFT. Yes.
So in the bulk, you have some fluctuations.
Yes.
So what does that translate into?
The quantum fluctuations?
Yeah.
There are corrections to this formula. So this should be the leading formula as G Newton goes to zero, and then there should be quantum corrections and so forth. This is somewhat of an expansion.
Some saddle point.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So this is the leading term in the classical gravity limit. That's the preview, but let me get to a second motivation to set up the calculation, which is that entanglement entropy provides RG monotone. So this is another interesting reason to try to calculate entanglement entropy in quantum field theories. And so the idea here is you have some renormalization group flow, say between two fixed points, which are the CFTs. You have some UV CFT and some IR CFT. And let's, for simplicity, assume that this flow preserves relativistic invariance. Essentially you can show that renormalization, the RG flow is irreversible if you can find some intrinsic property to this UV CFT, some intrinsic quantity CUV, CIR, such that this is bigger. And this, then you know that you can never reverse the flow. And this is just the intuition that C sort of counts the number of degrees of freedom, and as you integrate things out, you lose degrees of freedom, right? As you coarse grain. Of course, these functions exist in two dimensions, three dimensions, and four dimensions. More interestingly for me is that in 2D, so 1+1, and 3D, you can prove such a statement using entanglement entropy, okay? And so this is This is essentially work by Cassini and Poynter. Let me give an example of how this works. So in three dimensions, you have you can define the following quantity. Actually, this was first defined by Liu and Metze. Call it F. So you just take some derivatives of the entanglement entropy of a circular region. So we're now going to specialize to A here being a circular region of radius R. And so then you take some derivatives of this, and this is some function F. And it turns out that you can prove, just based on strong subadditivity of entanglement entropy, that F prime of R is less than or equal to zero. And so once you've shown this, and you show the fact that as essentially R goes to zero, you get the result at the CUV fixed point, which I'll call FUV, and as R goes to infinity, you get the result of the IR fixed point, then this is enough to prove this statement.
Yes? You are using relativistic in there at some point.
Yes, I have assumed this flow is relativistic.
But in that argument over there, where did you use relativistic in
there? Sorry. Plus relativistic. So this takes a lot of work, actually. There's a lot in this thing that I'm not
going to. Right. So. There are counterexamples without them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there are certainly counter. Yes. Good. So now let me sort of introduce this a little bit more physically, maybe for some people in the crowd. Let's imagine this UV CFT is actually a quantum critical point. And then the IR CFT, or the IR, is just a trivial gapped phase. So what am I imagining? I'm imagining, you know, I have some lattice system. Let's say, for simplicity, let's just work in 2+1 dimensions. I have some lattice system, and I have some tuning parameter called T. And as a function of that tuning parameter, at zero temperature, I can have a phase transition, say, between some symmetry broken phase, some gapped phase, and this is some critical coupling TC. And you can characterize this phase transition, if it's a second order continuous phase transition, by the critical fluctuations, the quantum fluctuations, and you can characterize that by a diverging correlation length. So this goes to infinity as t goes to tc. And in particular, in this limit, if the correlation length is much bigger than the lattice spacing, then I can essentially argue that I can describe this phase transition by quantum field theory. At the critical point, it should be scale invariant. Let's assume that it also has dynamical critical exponent z equals 1, and then I get a CFT with some assumptions. So this point is then described by a CFT. Okay, and so let's think about a way to characterize what's going on at this critical point, and one way is actually to use entanglement entropy. So in particular, at the critical point, if I calculate the entanglement entropy, the answer that I get is actually something that is cutoff dependent, so it depends on the lattice scale, A, where this entanglement entropy is essentially coming from UV entanglement or short distance entanglement between degrees of freedom at the boundary of the region A. So that's why the answer is proportional to the area of the boundary of the region A, or the length in this case. But there's an important correction to this, which is this number here. Okay, and so in some sense, if you ignore this, then this is an order parameter for this quantum criticality. In particular, for a gapped trivial phase, this is zero. So if you calculate this and find this, then you know that you're at a critical point or in the topological phase. But let's ignore that for now. So now let's look slightly away from the critical point. So let's go to the gapped phase. T is bigger than TC. Then you have some finite but large correlation length. So let's work in the limit where this is true. So the correlation length is still much bigger than the lattice scale. And the size of our region R is of order the size of the correlation length. And so in this limit, I can use entanglement entropy essentially to probe the flow between this UV-CFT, this quantum critical point, and this trivial gapped phase. And you should find something like this if you were to do this calculation. It's probably going to be monotonically decreasing. Of course, this is not necessarily relativistic, but it'll look something like this. Goes to zero as R goes to infinity, and the crossover scale is just the correlation. Okay.
So there'll be all sorts of proportional to the area divided by the.
Right. Sorry, I didn't say this.
Correlation length squared. Are you somehow? And those will be the hominid terms.
Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm forming this combination here. Which essentially gets rid of the area term. So I should have said that. So the derivatives
the area
here
times the correlation length squared.
Yeah.
Okay. Are you working out that?
Yeah. So essentially, what you do is you calculate the entanglement entropy as a function of R. So this is for circular regions. The whole talk will be based on circular regions. That's really important. But then I take these derivatives, and these derivatives actually kill this term, right? So this is nice, right? And you're just left with this. And in principle, you should find something like this. Okay, so now the claim is that, so what I'm going to be interested in this talk is just what's happening up here. So just the leading corrections from this critical point. You find is that there's an expansion, so F looks like this. I get the value of the quantum critical point minus some number times R of the correlation length to the 2 of the nu. And so, for example, the correlation length is going like T minus TC to minus nu at the critical point, and so this is sort of the leading correction. So the claim is, I can calculate this leading correction, so this is nu. But the non-trivial claim is that actually to calculate this term, you find in doing it that the calculation directly maps to the GR problem. So that's the summary, which is somewhat non-trivial. And in particular, the change in entanglement entropy from the critical point is given by a formula which is like this.
Is there a quick way to see that exponent? I mean, it seems to be T minus TC squared.
So it's just the coupling squared. So I'm going to do perturbation theory. So in principle, there are terms that I might miss because I'm doing perturbation theory. So this term is just the couple. So I'll explain that in a second.
So Tom, are you saying that there's two ways that you do the calculation once not using Einstein's equation, and then you check that it actually...
Yes, I mean, that's true, but also you can show that the field theory calculation, after a series of steps, directly maps onto the GR.
When you write delta SEE equals star, what's
star? Star is this formula, sorry. And it's the change in this formula. I'll specify this problem in more detail.
So you are
including
the area terms.
Right.
There's more than one area, sorry.
Yeah, it's true. There are some area terms that I'm neglecting here. So that this is the term that I'm interested in, essentially, because it survives this derivative.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you like, then take the derivatives of this formula, and then you get something interesting. Let me sort of give the results a little bit more carefully. More precisely, this quantum critical point is described I can essentially describe it by a CFT plus the leading relevant coupling, which is this operator O. This operator O has dimensions delta, which is then in this critical exponent U, which appeared in this formula via this. And so the precise claim is the following formula. If critical point, so this is the first claim. And this was essentially the original goal of what I was trying to do. I managed to do this. Find this answer with some numbers, and I calculated those numbers. And so actually it turns out that this result was obtained previously, but it was obtained using ADF CFT, so it was obtained for theories with a classical gravity dual. The claim is that this term holds more universally than that. Okay, and actually the second claim is more bold, is that if I do this deformation, but I now include inhomogeneous couplings, I can even include a metric deformation coupling to the stress tensor, then the change in entanglement entropy from the quantum critical value at order lambda squared, so second order in the coupling, and at first order in H, is just given by the change in the area of some metric over 4g newton, where the metric is just the following. So again, you know, I have this picture essentially of ADS-CFT. I have my region A here. I have some metric in the bulk, which is ADS plus a small fluctuation. And then this is the Z direction. And then I have my original sort of root Takinagi surface, this minimal surface for the CFT. And then this metric fluctuation, you know, essentially causes this minimal surface to fluctuate, and that it's the change in that area that is the claimed answer to the entanglement entropy.
Sorry, Tom?
Yes.
Can you just clarify in claim one?
Yeah.
Like, what? Are you making a statement about the endpoint of the RG flow you get by turning
on? No.
Or you're just saying very near?
Very near, yeah. So this is the this is the leading correction and perturbation
line for non necessarily conformal theories, and this is just the first thing that happens to it.
Yeah, that's right. It turns out so there is, I should say there is an exception to this in some sense. We know I've assumed that I'm doing a perturbation expansion, but we know actually that there's a more important term when delta is less than d over 2, which is non analytic in lambda. So I can't see that. But this is responsible for the non-stationarity of F. But you know, this is something else. Okay. So I can see the perturbative answer.
Delta G equal to lambda.
Delta G. Yes. So I'm going to tell you how delta G is related to everything. So we should solve the following set of equations: Einstein's equations. Coupled to some stress tensor for some bulk scalar field. So I have to add in this bulk space-time. So remember, this is the boundary where the quantum field theory lives, and I have to add in this bulk space-time essentially a free field phi, which solves the Klein-Gordon equation with some mass. And then I have some boundary conditions, which is that the metric should go to this at the boundary, and the scalar field should go to this at the boundary, and the full solution to this equation should be regular, so it should be some regularity. So this is a unique problem, right? this is a unique problem that you solve. It's essentially a set of linearized PDEs. So I should have said that you solve this equation to phi of order lambda and delta g of order lambda squared and h. T mu nu is the canonical stress tensor associated with the phi, so it depends on the square of phi. So in delta g c is the square of the coupling lambda. So once you do this, you solve this perturbatively like this, then you calculate delta g, and then the answer is just the change in the area.
In the claim 2, what happened to the correction to the error log, the entanglement entropy?
Which correction?
The higher derivative.
The higher derivative, yeah. So I'm going to get to that.
Is the formula correct?
Let me explain.
Well, this is linearized.
Let me get to it. So it's right. So So let me make some comments now. So this is the problem. This is well defined. So I can calculate this in principle for any deformation. Small definition. So G Newton, which I haven't specified, but it's fixed by the normalization of the TT two-point function in the CFT. So this is some function which is fixed by conformal invariance up to an overall number, and then G Newton is fixed by that number. I'm taking my AES scale to be 1, and then my cosmological constant, something like this. Upon presenting this result, I generally get two reactions. One is that this is obviously wrong. Okay. And it seems obviously wrong because it's outside of the regime of validity that you usually expect. So in particular, I haven't said anything about the number of degrees of freedom. I haven't said anything about strong coupling. Okay. And in particular, one objection is, in principle, G Newton here, which is just fixed by this TT two-point function, could be a number of order 1. So maybe it's not even clear what I mean by this. It is clear what I mean by this. I just mean solve the linearized ODEs. That's all I mean. Okay. So the other reaction is that this is obviously correct. And obviously, I'm more sympathetic to this. the reason's obviously correct, and it's not so obvious, I would say. But after doing the calculation, it becomes obvious. So it turns out that CFT calculation that you do only depends on the following data. It only depends on the two-point function in the CFT, the TOO three-point function, and the TT two-point function, as I said here. And so these are all the same in any CFT up to overall normalization. So all all I'm doing is fixing that normalization essentially by playing around with my parameters in the gravity problem. So in particular, for example, if I was to set up this problem in a gravity dual which had a quantum, a horrible quantum gravity description where G Newton is of order 1, I could do this calculation maybe with a lot of power. But at the end of the day, I'm going to get exactly the same answer as if I did it with this, and then I just continued G Newton to be of order 1. Right? So in particular, if I did it with this, where G Newton is very small, where you expect classical gravity to work, and then sort of analytically continue G Newton to be of order 1, then I would get exactly the same answer.
This case, I'm still just in 3 dimensions, or would you expect?
It's in any dimensions.
But as soon as you thought about a four-point function,
exactly. So the other thing to say is, at some higher order in perturbation theory, I'm going to lose this universality. Okay. So this is only true for certain leading terms around the quantum critical point.
This coupling that you're adding, that lambda is a function of x and t. All the coordinates of the CFT.
Yeah, you can think about this in Euclidean space as some Euclidean path integral, or you can just make it independent of t if you don't want to think about time evolution or anything. There's some general thing that you can do here, which is actually clear from the calculation, essentially because it maps to ADS CFT, and we know how these things work in ADS CFT.
Yeah, I was just, usually these surfaces are on some time slice, and so
right.
I want to know whether you're solving a higher dimensional Einstein equation or
something. Well, so. Right. No, it's a high dimensional. It's in ADS-D plus 1, where D is the space-time dimension of the boundary theory. And actually, the problem I've stated, because I don't really want to worry about real-time stuff, is a Euclidean problem. Okay. But you know, in principle, you should be able to understand dynamics within this formalism as well. Okay, so let me. So this is the result. I'm going to, you know, sketch the calculation.
Tom, are you going to comment more about these non-analytic things that happen for delta less than d over g?
Yeah, I wish I could. it would be really nice to derive those terms, but I haven't managed to.
But I mean, just to get an idea of what they are.
Oh, right.
Is there a description of what they are? Is, you know, it, when they happen in the holographic case?
Yeah, example? Yeah. So we actually know. Nishioka Tatsuma wrote a paper on this. It's essentially, you know, you have this other term here. What is it here? That and this sort of contaminates the boundary area, right? And so you get a contribution from this, which you can sort of think of as.
A contribution directly to the entropy from.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All
right. Right. So it should be something you can derive. Even though it's non-analytic, it means you have to resum an infinite number.
Non-analytic in lambda?
In the coupling, yeah, because the van der Waal in one of these RG flows is lambda to some power, you know, even when it's delta.
You're just doing the alternate quantization, right? I mean.
Yeah, so in a large N theory, you probably could make progress with this, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, usually things in conformal perturbation theory, these non-analytic terms arise because of infrared.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So actually, when you do this calculation, you see an infrared divergence when this happens. So probably you can fix it up. I haven't managed to do it. I would like to, because these terms have, you know, somewhat puzzled people in the past. So, okay. But I'm going to just look at this analytic term. Okay. So the sketch of the calculation is follows. Right, so I have to tell you a little bit about entanglement in CFTs. So if we have a ball-shaped region in a CFT, A bar, you know, and then we have our reduced density matrix, which is the trace over the CFT vacuum of A bar. It turns out that, well, you can always write this in the following form. HA is some Hermitian operator. You can always do that. But it turns out for ball-shaped regions in CFTs, H has a very simple expression. And so H is sometimes called the entanglement Hamiltonian, sometimes called the modular Hamiltonian, depending on which community you're from. But essentially the important, you know, so the workhorse of the results is that in a CFT, so, you know, here I'm setting all my couplings to zero, is the following. It's the following operator. Okay, and there's Z here. The way to see this, so this is a result you'd seen in Hort de Meyers. And the way to see this is the following. Essentially, the idea is actually to start in a different problem. So instead of thinking about entanglement entropy for ball-shaped regions, we think about entanglement entropy for half of all space. So A is half of all space, and A bar is everything else. Then it turns out you can consider a family of uniformly accelerated observers. So in space-time, these look like this. So here is my x direction. So I'm just going to project. So I'm going to forget about all the transverse directions. Here is A, here is A bar, and this is the time direction, and this is real time. Then you can consider a family of observers which are uniformly accelerated, which looks something like this. These are called Rindler observers. It turns out that, you know, because essentially these observers don't have access to anything that happens over here, there's a horizon for these observers, they naturally see rho A. So everything for them is described in terms of rho A. And in particular, essentially, because there's a horizon, and because we know from Hawking and others that to every horizon like this, there's a temperature and there should be a thermal state. It turns out that a result due to Unruh is that you can write this density matrix as a Gibbs state, Kx, where Kx is just the generator of boosts in the quantum field theory in the x direction. Okay, so just to be clear, this is a result for relativistic quantum field theory. See, I didn't need conformal invariants. But for relativistic quantum field theories, you can show that this is true. This is an operator in the CFT. In general, all of these operators can be written like this. Essentially an integral over region A, which here is half of all space, of the stress tensor times some vector field times the area element, which is normal to the region A. And this vector field, in this case, is just the reduced killing vector. In fact, this boost killing vector has integral curves that look exactly like this. Okay, so I can just define it like this. So this is for any quantum field theory, but it turns out that in a CFT, I can make a conformal transformation, which essentially maps sort of this half space under a conformal transformation, and you map to a ball. Okay, and a ball of some radius r. And it's important that this conformal transformation preserves the vacuum. And so under this, I can essentially do this conformal transformation on this Unruh problem and calculate what Kx should be, and it turns out to be this. So in particular, if you look at this Rindler wedge, so this wedge here, these observers, under this conformal transformation, it goes to the following region, where A is here. So this is A is this ball-shaped region, which I'm only showing a one-dimensional slice of. A complement lives out here. This is the time direction. And so in particular, these boost generators, this boost vector field, essentially goes to a conformal killing vector field. So C mu in this case is a conformal killing vector. And then HA is just the generator of this conformal transformation, or at least of the conformal boost, if you like. Conformal boost. So it's the generator which essentially moves you along these curves here. Just like this was the generator which boosts you up here. Okay. So this was for CFT. Now, for perturbations to CFT, I'm going to I'm going to follow the following idea. Actually, I can do this calculation in two ways. I'm going to present one of the ways. The other way is the replica trick. So you can do this with a replica trick. It's very subtle, but you can see the details in my paper. It has somewhat of a relation to previous results by Hedrick and Cardi and Calabresi on calculating entanglement entropies for regions which are very far apart. But I'm going to do this in a slightly different way. So, So the idea is that I can write my reduced density matrix for my region A as rho naught, so this is the CFT answer, which we know the form, plus some direction, delta rho. And so this is actually the method that that Smolk and Rosenhaus used. And so the idea is then, you know, so delta rho in perturbation theory essentially depends on, it is of order h lambda, or this is the orders that we need to keep in delta rho, something of order h, something of order lambda, something of order lambda squared. And then you take this and you plug this into the entanglement entropy and you expand. Okay, so it seems pretty simple. At first order, the claim is actually that only the H perturbation matters, right? So at first order, the coupling to the scalar field, to the operator O, it doesn't matter, or it vanishes. The first order perturbation vanishes. But the metric perturbation doesn't. And essentially the answer that you get is just what you get from expanding trace. So we're going to expand trace rho log rho. The log rho term doesn't matter, essentially, because the normalization of rho is fixed. And so all you get is the variation from here. Right? And so I can write this in a different form, which is just 2 pi times the variation in the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian H in a non-trivial state, or non-trivial, in the presence of this non-trivial deformation H. Okay. So this is the first order correction. And this has some nice properties. In particular, this equation looks a little bit like PDS is VE. So this looks like the first law, right, where this is DS, this is DE, and T is, as usual, one of the 2 pi. This has an interesting way to interpret it in terms of angular CFT. I may get to this at the end of the talk, I may not, but I really want to get to the second order variation, which is essentially the main technical events of my paper. So second order. Okay, so at second order, there's 2 terms. There's 2 kinds of terms. So here, you know, I'm just interested in the relevant deformation. So forget the stress tensor deformation for now. Okay. So at second order, there are 2 kinds of terms. There's the first term, which I'll call 1, which comes from essentially delta rho here being order lambda squared. Okay. And it turns out that you can go through the same derivation here, and you essentially get something which looks exactly like this equation. So delta S1 is 2 pi times the variation in the modular Hamiltonian at order lambda squared. Okay. So this is the first term. I will probably refer to this term as the first law term. And the second term comes from delta rho being of order lambda whole squared. Okay, so it's sort of the second order term that you get from expanding this. And so this turns out to be what I think is the most interesting term. I'm going to call this the relative entropy term. And so the reason it's the relative entropy is I can essentially turn this equation around and show that the change, the second order term, it's actually the minus of the relative entropy, is the change in the entanglement entropy minus the contribution from the first law terms, which is this. And this is actually just equal to the relative entropy between the perturbed density matrix and the CFT density matrix at order lambda squared. Okay. So relative entropy has some nice properties. I can write it like this. Trace rho log rho minus log rho naught. And it's nice, you know, to organize, you know, to keep track of these properties in the calculation. So for example, the relative entropy is positive and so forth. So the difficulty with calculating this term, this second order term, is essentially because rho, so essentially the difficulty is that rho naught and delta rho don't commute. And you have this log here, and it's somewhat difficult to deal with this. So it turns out that the difficulty in dealing with this is important for seeing the ADS-C of T emerge, which I think is somewhat interesting. So one way to deal with it is to write log rho in integral form. Something like this. And then to just expand this. Now, this is easier to deal with in perturbation theory. So in particular, at second order, you can show using this that this relative entropy term has the following form. This is nice, but actually there's a more interesting representation, which I'll write, and then I'll explain roughly how you get this. I can write this as following. Trace rho naught is the rho, rho naught to the minus is minus 1 to the rho. And essentially, you know, going from here to here is kind of like going from old-fashioned perturbation theory in quantum mechanics to time-dependent perturbation theory, roughly speaking. But you get some kernel here, which has some form, something like this. And this kernel is non-trivial, essentially, because, you know, this calculation is slightly different to that quantum mechanics calculation that I just mentioned. Okay, but now the important thing now is that the delta rho that we're interested in has the following expression. So I can write it as follows. It's an integral over this operator deformation times the coupling, where this integral, I'll take it just to be in Euclidean space. So this is over all of sort of RD Euclidean space. And this is a result which is essentially due to Smolkin and Rosenhaus. In short, this is justified essentially using a Euclidean path integral representation for the density matrix, and then essentially doing perturbation theory using this Euclidean path integral. But you get something like this. Okay. And so what happens now? When you plug this into here, is you get these sort of delta rho conjugated by rho to the is, rho naught to the minus is. And remember, rho naught is e to the minus 2 pi h a. So what happens is you're essentially conjugating this operator by this conformal transformation. So in particular, you can write an expression for this. So rho naught is over hat of x, rho naught to minus is, is essentially given by Upton conformal factors, which I'm not going to talk about. The operator inserted at another point, which is generated from x by a flow, which is generated by this conformal boost. So essentially, what happens is, if you had some operator which happened to be living on A, so it's here. Remember, this is an integral over all Euclidean space, so we're never going into real time, which is in this direction. And what this does is this pushes you along it pushes you in this direction along one of these generators by some amount s. Okay. So this is this operator here.
But it stays local?
Yeah, it stays local, and that's because it's a conformal field theory. So there are some conformal factors here, but it does stay local, yes.
So now you assume that O of x is time independent.
No. I can't draw this picture anymore when the operator is away. This is just to give you some intuition. But in general, you know, I have some expression essentially. You know, you can always do this modular transformation on this coordinate x. So you can always do this this boost, this conformal boost on this coordinate x. So the important point, really the important point here, is that the relative entropy can be written as some integral over x1, x2, times some integral over s with some kernel, times the two-point function in the CFT of an operator at x1s, which is this image of x under this modular flow, times x2. Okay. So really the important point here is that the answer is just depends on the CFT two-point function. So in a sense, here I could stop because I know that it depends on the CFT two-point function, so then it should be universal. And I wanted to show that it works, and so you need to make a few more steps to do this. And unfortunately, I'm not going to give the details because they're rather complicated. But essentially, after doing some massaging of these integrals, so I can write this down, right? This is a two-point function in the CFT. I can write the answer for this down. So in principle, this is just a whole mess of integrals that I have to do. And so I can do some, there's a churn that I do, and then I get the following answer. Which looks like this. Where you know I have to define various things in this equation, essentially xb, which appears here. xb, which appears here, is some coordinate, is some point in ADS, is naturally interpreted as a point in ADS, which I'll describe in a second, and k delta is the bulk to boundary propagator for some scalar field phi, some Klein-Gordon field phi with a mass, which is this. And so what is this? This point, xb, it turns out to be a point which I can just draw as follows. So here is my boundary theory. Here's the time direction, here's the x direction. Here is this domain of dependence of A, this causal diamond here. And then I have this extra z direction. Then I have my minimal surface that comes down here. And this point, xb, actually lies on this null surface, which I can draw, which is essentially a null surface generated by null geodesics, which come out of this minimal surface here. Here, and in particular, along these null generators, I have some coordinate xb, and then everything else are these coordinates yb.
Where did the emergence of extra direction come in? The S became somehow the emergence.
Yeah, it's a Schwinger parameter. I don't know why. It turns out when you do these integrals and you try and massage, this is a Schwinger parameter. So this is the answer that you get, and it's pretty easy once you see this to interpret this answer. So in particular, let me define a bulk field. Essentially, by doing these integrals now over these bulk to boundary propagators. So it's just an integral over x1, lambda 1, k delta, xv, x1. So this is a bulk field. It satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation because this was a bulk to boundary propagator. And I can pretty simply then write the relative entropy term as just an integral over this null surface, this horizon, of the stress tensor, the null stress tensor, associated to the scalar field. So this is just T plus plus is just the derivative of phi squared. So once you see this pop out, it's really natural to interpret this in terms of holography. So let me sort of explain a few things that went into this churn that arrived at this answer.
Where did you the TOO correlator?
So that's in this first law piece. Okay. So there's the other piece that I've thrown in, and you'll see how that comes about in a second. This is the answer.
Formula above that, there's nothing else on the right hand side, like some O at X.
This thing here?
No, it's right above your box formula there.
So this is the bulked boundary propagator, essentially Euclidean space.
Yes. At lambda? Okay.
Right. Lambda of x1, there's an integral of x1, and then this is a field.
Lambda's like the source, right? So
this yeah, lambda is
not a
source.
Smearing function.
It's not a smearing function. Yeah, it's not. This is a source.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, so this is just a response.
Yeah, that's right. There are various things that went into this. I may mention this or not. Firstly, it was important to do this calculation to write the two-point function in terms of embedding space, in the embedding space formalism. And essentially, you can think about the CFT as living on the following space, which is in along this curve, which is in R1 D plus 1, and then identifying projectively P and lambda P. And so this has two more dimensions than the space that it should live on, but then there's this one condition, and then there's this gauge condition here, and so you just get a D-dimensional space. It's nice to do this essentially because the conformal group, Euclidean conformal group, acts nicely on this space, right? So it sort of makes sort of conformal invariance manifest. So there's actually two advantages in this calculation to doing it. One is that this modular flow, this thing which generates this flow under this flow by parameter S, is just a rotation in this space. So I just rotate my coordinates, basically an SO2 rotation in this subspace of this. The other advantage is that ADS is just this space, -1, in the same RD, R1, and D plus 1. Okay, so ADS D plus 1 has a natural sort of representation in this space, so it's actually fairly natural that ADS appears out of this calculation. And so this was important. The other thing that's really important was to relearn how to use Schringer parameters, which... But intuitively, I think what's happening here is that this modular transformation on this operator is essentially, which is moving you into real times, essentially allows you to see what's happening in the bulk, right? So it's allowing you to reconstruct this bulk field in some sense.
This is the thing you'd integrate to find a correction to the area by bifurcation surface.
Right. So this is the answer for one of the terms in the entanglement entropy. Now I have to relate it to an area thing. An area term, and so the idea there is just very simply to introduce a metric. So the idea is, well, we have AES now, so let's put a metric on it. In particular, a metric with a small fluctuation. So we're going to put GADS plus delta G, and then demand that it solves Einstein's equations, sourcing this stress tensor, D++, which sort of arises out of the calculation. And then once you do that, you can actually integrate this equation, and you can show that this is basically just the area term due to this perturbation at the minimal surface, minus the term at the boundary. And it turns out, after some work, you can show that this boundary term is exactly this first law contribution, or minus the first law contribution, and so it cancels it. And so this is the answer. Okay. So this is the claimed answer for the entanglement theory.
So should I have expected a bulk contribution to the
Right, so that would come, you know, so if there were quantum corrections and so forth, you could try to calculate those. But my claim is that it wouldn't change the answer. It might change the overall scale of the answer, but because all of the calculation just depended on the two-point function and some three-point functions, they're universal, and so it doesn't matter. So all it would do is change the parameters in that calculation.
There might be a one-loop renormalization of G Newton.
That's right. So for okay.
It's only for some class of states, what
you say? Yeah, so it's for this, well, I mean, in my language, it's in perturbation theory, where I'm deforming my Hamiltonian, and I'm calculating the first order in perturbation theory.
But in the vacuum.
In the vacuum.
Now, in principle, you can extend this calculation to certain states which aren't the vacuum by doing some Euclidean path integral.
And then you might
then evolving in real time.
Terms,
but then you would lose your universality.
Sorry?
If you did that, you'd lose your universality.
Not for some particular set of states. No. You can still do it, I think. Okay, so basically, just to conclude, well, okay, maybe I won't say too much. You know, I think that there are some interesting extensions of this work. For example, the real-time evolution of entanglement entropy, which I suspect will also be governed by Einstein's equations for certain states. I also think various geometric quantities, if you start including stress tensor deformations and going to second order in stress tensor deformations, there should be some universality that appears there too. Right, so I think there's sort of lots of extensions. Let me finish.
Could you elaborate a little more on that last statement you made that might still hold for a certain class of states?
Yeah, I think a class of states is something like this. Just small perturbations to the vacuum that look like this. And I think these are the kinds of states that you can get in perturbation theory and using, sort of a Euclidean path integral. And then you can evolve forward in time, and you should be able to calculate the entanglement entropy for these states. Essentially using exactly the same calculation.
Right? Doesn't that need to use a four-point function?
Yeah, no. I mean, not to second order in this coupling.
Yeah.
Yes?
If you want your function f of lambda to be really decreasing along RG trajectories,
right,
you really need to compute the order lambda cubed. I mean, it's kind of... You want the derivative of f with respect to lambda to be proportional to the beta function. So the
yes.
fact that the first term is of order lambda squared is kind of trivial from that.
Right. I mean, I think that's not...
You would really need to compute the three-point function just to actually...
I think the statement about it being proportional to the beta function is not really true. Essentially, like, you can see that because of these non-analytic terms.
Oh, apart from the non-analytic
right.
terms, which somehow, if you do, you can somehow, in other similar problems, they sort of go away if you compute a beta function, because they're...
I see. Okay, maybe.
Infrared problems rather than UV problems, but...
I see.
So my question was, can you actually compute the
lambda cube.
Yeah.
So there's the relative entropy contribution, which is, you know, what I harped on about here. You can calculate because it just depends on the three-point function. But then I'm not actually sure about the other term. It, in principle, it depends on this, which I think is not, you know, it's not. It depends on your theory.
In higher dimensions.
In higher dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm not sure, you know, in some sense this was a trivial term in this calculation, so it might be that this is also trivial here. And so you can calculate the cubed correction as well. But, you know, the other thing to say is if you could, then it's probably going to be the same answer as the gravity calculation. So you could predict what it is in some sense.
How restrictive it is that it has to be a spherical?
Yeah, that's completely restrictive. That doesn't work if it's anything else. So you might try to deform the surface a little bit, and that you can achieve by adding stress tensor deformations. So you could understand perturbations to the surface from being a circle. But otherwise, you know,
the
important. You know, this sort of statement that rho is zero for the CFT and this was essentially what allowed me to do this calculation. If I don't have this, then I can't do anything.
I'm a bit confused on the overall message.
Yes.
This is true for all CFTs.
Yeah.
And we know that these CFT most likely doesn't have a Lagrangian dual.
Yeah.
Some CFT perturbation, it's not going to hold. So, the message is that at low orders in perturbation theory, some features of gravity remain.
I think so. That's right. It's quite surprising, I guess.
And can one see that? So the original result you wrote down
is
non-trivial power, 2G power.
Yeah. So
how do you see?
Well, you know, it comes from. I mean, basically, then once you've mapped this to ASFT, then you can look up this paper by Lou Metzger, who did that calculation. I was originally trying to find a much more direct way of doing these integrals to calculate that term, but it turned out that the non-direct way was the best way to go.
But does it give me any insight which CFT and ASFT will not hold? Like if I go higher order, or it has to go higher order to see that something doesn't work.
Yeah. So at next order, maybe lambda cubed is okay, but lambda the fourth is going to be totally non-universal.
Right. So in principle, does that calculation?
You can do ADACFT as a machine for reproducing all conformal correlation functions.
But I think it. I mean, what's important is that this non-trivial statement that it does depend on the two-point function, which wasn't clear from the get-go.
This is testing some non-local aspects.
So that's one thing I was going to say. Actually, the agreement is actually follows from conformal invariance. It's basically a highly non-trivial check of conformal invariance.
Does this have any simple causality properties? You know, like if you only change the state inside that region, it shouldn't affect the entanglement entropy, for example.
Answer to that would be that if ADS-CFT does, then yes, it does.
Just depending on what. This is some response to a source, right? So that doesn't have simple locality properties.
The way that I've set it up is somewhat weird, but you know, I think you can talk about real-time evolution, and then these things should become clear.
Maybe just to say that expression involves an integral over the entire source, right? Another thing one could be worried about is if something like this worked for non-trivial states, then you might, you know, the entanglement entropy is very, that's like a precursor, it knows what's happening in the bulk, whereas these two and three-point functions don't. So if you had...
It might be that this is what gives you, right? So the fact that you're in real time, you're actually probing things away, you know, in this causal diamond, this is usually, I think this is somewhat important. This is what allows you to reach into the bulk as a sort of a precursor.
If the place where you change your Hamiltonian is localized, then these things will integrate to zero?
I haven't checked it explicitly, but we can, yeah, we can check that. Yes.
Do you again explain why this is a local operator? Because you're doing some real-time evolution on some operator with respect to some complicated Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So why should it be local?
An integral over different x's. An integral of local operators.
Yeah, it's still an integral over S, right? There's a kernel, right? But this, you're asking just specifically about
should
this.
It should become more complicated, right?
Not in a CFD. If this was Rindler space, and this was the generator of the boost, this would just be this operator up here, right? And you're comfortable with that.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. There are some conformal factors that I didn't write down. I don't know exactly. I can't remember the exact form of them, but some right.
It's a local operator on the later time slice. It's not it's a local
operator. Right. Sorry. Yeah.
If I expand in terms of the T is going to
zero. The same for.
Yeah, but this is.
That's true for ordinary Hamiltonian.
I'm just
relabeling the time.
That's what it means. And this is enough to allow you to calculate the correlation function. That's what was important here.
This would not work for a non-spherical region.
No.
It wouldn't be local.
Then that would not be a local operator on any slice.
I mean, if this was saying something deep about the connection between CFT and gravity, then you might expect it to work for arbitrary shapes.
Well, why?
Just like in the other context in which you and other people have shown with,
entanglement. Yeah. So, I mean, but there was more that went into that, like large N and this condition on the spectrum, and none of that went into here. So I think if you want to, you know, my suspicion is that, you know, maybe if you just have large N, then a formula like that applies, but it may be some non-local horrible thing, right? Which would be really interesting in itself, but at least in this limit, it should reproduce gravity. So that's kind of an interesting check of any answer that you have.
Maybe the other thing that's surprising, which I didn't understand, is the fact that this formula itself you expect will get corrected as you go to weak lambda. The fact that the entanglement entropy is proportional not to the area, but there are all these other corrections. Seem to drop out of this relation.
So what are you saying?
You might have expected that you know that there are higher derivative connections to the Ruta-Ganagi formula itself.
Okay.
They don't seem to appear here.
But let me say this in this way. Let's say you were to calculate. Okay. So let me say one thing. If you were to do this for a stress tensor at second order, it would depend on the TTT three-point function, right? That has interesting structures that more than one parameter, right? And so the suspicion is for that calculation, I would need to correct this so that I wouldn't just have I wouldn't just have the area formula, I would have higher derivative corrections. Maybe my Einstein's equations will also have higher derivative corrections, and that will work. But the same can be said about if I were to calculate just a three-point function in ADS CFT using sort of Witten diagrams, right? At large N, this is what you would do for a classical gravity dual, but there are all sorts of corrections to this. Okay? All they can do is change the parameters. And so that's what's going into this.
Okay, I think there's no more questions. It's time to